My guest tonight is James Corbett of The Corbett Report. He comes on the show tonight to discuss his rather excellent documentary that came out a few weeks ago, How Big Oil Conquered the World, or The Rise of the Oiligarchy. It's the title I like. But so, James, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for having me on again.
Well, thank you for coming on. Listen, this documentary it's very sweeping, but it's a wonderful distillation of a very complex history. So I want to compliment you on that.
Well, thank you for that. I'm glad it came across that way because I realized as I was doing it that it got to a point where every single section that I was working on could have been a documentary unto itself. So I'm glad that it does come across as sweeping, but hopefully comprehensible.
And that's what we encourage, because people who watch this documentary who maybe may not be familiar with the history, there's libraries of books written on each of these topics, and you can really sink your teeth into it and you really make a career out of delving into each one of these talks, whether it's the Federal Reserve, whether it's the wars, like the oil wars, the geostrategy, the British geostrategy, and all this against Germany, the rise of the oil barons in the United States, and all the intrigues that it involved in, and of course the post-war era with the rise of the Bretton Woods system, the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, and the oil crisis of the engineered oil crisis of the 70s, which I'm sure we'll get into. So yeah, it is a great history. For those who are familiar with it, it's a great, again, just a great. I guess you could say just a brief topic of a reminder of all these things and how they're all interrelated. And so it really it's I think it's a documentary for everybody. So I really encourage
you. Good. Well, that was certainly the intention. And really, I mean, in many ways, I said this before in a previous interview, I'd like to reiterate it. In many ways, this is kind of a culmination of the past, decade of research that I've done now on so many different things. And it ties a lot of them together. And I think this is one of the core underlying threads of that narrative that I've been really painting for the past not going on 9 years now at CorbettReport.com. So again, if it seems like it covers a vast amount of information, that's because it really is a condensation of really thousands and thousands of hours of research.
And unfortunately, there's no substitute for putting that time into it. You have to.
No.
Yeah. Now, we can hope to save some people some time by sparing them the lies and illusions that the status quo, the establishment, retails to them in the corporate media or the established education systems, things like that. But at the end of the day, you got to sit down, you got to turn off the TV, maybe get a drink, cup of coffee, or put on some jazz music or some classical music and do some reading, so you can really get your teeth into this. But let's get into the documentary itself. Here we have the documentary is broken up into, I guess, roughly four parts. And you have the birth of the oligarchy. And this is that part kind of centers on the rise of the Rockefellers. And what's interesting, particularly interesting about it, is his father, William Avery Rockefeller. What was his business?
What was his business? He was basically a scammer, a trickster, and he was quite notorious amongst the people that knew him for being such. I mean, there was no doubt about it. He would use all sorts of different tricks to try to scam people in different places. There were stories of him going to towns and showing up with a slate and some chalk and basically pretending to be deaf mute. And basically communicating with people that way in order to try to beg money off of them and things like that. I mean, just total scams. And so he was quite nefarious for that. And unfortunately, he did come across as something of a lovable rogue and was quite a handsome man from all accounts. So he got away with a lot. But in fact, he was, I mean, the moniker Devil Bill was applied to him sometimes and was unfortunately quite appropriate. He was not just philanderous, but there was accusations of rape in Cayuga in 1849 that caused him to flee his family. And he was actually in a bigamous marriage in Canada and at the same time was fathering two more children by a third woman. So he was definitely, not a very morally upstanding person, shall we say. And I find it, I mean, I found the whole story of Devil Bill interesting because it is generally acknowledged, even in the kind of Rockefeller whitewash type documentaries you might find on PBS or those types of books that are written about the Rockefeller family. They don't really hide Devil Bill per se, but the narrative that we're given is that, oh, well, John D. learnt from his father, oh, this is an evil man, but he was raised by his mother, who was a very pious woman, so he turned into a very pious, religious man, and that's kind of what shaped him to be different from his father. But I, on the other hand, see the similarities. And whereas, of course, Devil Bill was really just some sort of sociopath or psychopath who was able to treat people as just basically means to an end, in a very brute way, in a way that was easily demonstrably morally reprehensible, John Dee was really just quite a bit sharper about it, and was able to go about it in a way that absolutely did change people's lives. And to some extent, I think we'd have to say for the better. That's because I think the most insidious evil is perpetrated by giving people at least a little bit of what they want. If you're just 100% plain old evil, like Devil Bill, you're going to be rejected by society and you're not really going to make it very far in order to get into positions of power to have real power over people. But if you give people at least a little bit of what they want, then you can go a lot further. And I think that's really what John Dee ultimately ended up learning from Devil Bill. And of course, one of the famous quotes that we have from Devil Bill himself was that he bragged that, "I cheat my boys every chance I get. I want to make them sharp." And there's stories of, I believe it was David Rockefeller, or one of the David Rockefeller generation, talking about John Dee always trying to swindle or cheat the boys out of different deals or trades. He'd always try to, you know, do things like that in order to basically teach them how to be ruthless in business. And that was something that was important and ingrained in the family from a very young age. So those types of stories just show that although the Devil Bill story is usually treated as some sort of, you know, interesting backstory, that's some sort of a sideshow to the Rockefeller story, in some ways I think of it as being really the core of the Rockefeller story.
And he literally was a snake oil salesman, correct?
Yes, that's right. Sorry. And to answer your question, yes, he did actually pawn off a snake oil called Rock Oil, a tonic. It was a completely useless tonic that he it was just mixture of laxative and petroleum. He went from town to town pawning it off on people. Literally a snake oil salesman, which is interesting because, of course, as I go on to detail in the documentary, yes, the Rockefellers and their oligarchical brethren did, of course, give rise to the modern pharmaceutical industry and the sort of modern snake oil. And again, I think the connection is perhaps more explicit than some people would like to admit. As I point out in the documentary, the name that Devil Bill marketed his Rock Oil snake oil tonic under was Nujol, as in new oil. And Standard Oil, ultimately in the early 20th century, spun off Nujol as a laxative that they sold under their Stanco subsidiary. So they literally took the name Nujol from Devil Bill and continued using it for their own purposes in the new snake oil industry.
That's great. That's so interesting. And of course, the you alluded to some of these hagiographies that are produced about the Rockefellers, I guess you could say. I think one you used in the documentary is from the American Experience one, I believe.
That's right, yes.
And wasn't that brought to you by ConocoPhillips or ExxonMobil or something?
Not only that, but I remember there was a connection with, I think it was WGBH in, yeah, Washington, is actually owned by a Rockefeller, Sharon Percy Rockefeller.
Okay. Yeah. Well,
married into the Rockefeller family. So there's a lot of connections like that between the various hagiographies and,
yeah,
and the family itself.
Yeah, so it's the Rockefellers having to deal with their wealth and their noblesse oblige and how they struggle to improve the world. And yeah, that's, you know, that documentary, I happened to watch or listen to a bunch of it because Richard Grove pulled a lot of it, one of his Peace Revolution podcasts.
Right. And, yeah.
It's fascinating.
It is important for, I think, people who are interested to at least understand that story, that version of the story.
Of
and
course,
there are a lot,
yes,
of facts in there, but of course they're spun, as I say, in a way that paints the family in the best possible, mm-hmm, light. Mm-hmm.
And it's just interesting. Now Devil Bill had to be somewhat successful because apparently he loaned John D. Rockefeller $1,000 to, which wasn't a small amount of money in that day, to start his business. So,
yes, that's right.
He was somewhat of a...
And, of course, he paid 9% interest on it, as David Rockefeller points out. Yes,
yeah, like,
he paid 9% interest, and it was a $1,000 loan to start his career, yeah, off. So, yes, the seed money for the Rockefeller fortune literally came from Devil Bill. Mm-hmm.
So you have John D. Rockefeller, I guess, this, I guess you could say a bookkeeper,
That's right. He started out as a bookkeeper. Yeah. I can't remember exactly what business he was in, but he was interested in the petroleum business right from the time when it started taking off. And he was reading about it and getting very much interested in it. And he ended up teaming up with one of the people that he was working with in a little project to try to start their own petroleum refinery. And they got into that business. And from that, he started leveraging control by basically strong-arming various people in Cleveland, and he ultimately took over the Cleveland market, which at the time was really the booming place for the refining, because he had worked out basically the real money was to be made from refining, not from, you know, digging the wells. That was, you know, you could get money if you were lucky and struck the right place, but if you had real business acumen, you could find a way to cut corners here and there and save a penny here and there and really make a business out of it. And that was really his dream.
So in 1870, Standard Oil is incorporated, and that's when they borrow heavily from the banks. One is National City Bank in Cleveland. I think I mentioned to you before recording that is rumored to be owned by the Rothschilds. But as I said, if you're involved in banking at some level,
especially in that era,
you're going to run into the Rothschilds. But of course, when he gains a measure of success. This is the age when oil is being used primarily for lighting, right?
Yes, exactly. So at the time when this was really when the oil industry was first taking off, it was primarily used for kerosene and for lamp oil, basically. And that was what it was for. That was why it was being used. That was why it was so wildly popular, because it was at least in part replacing the whale blubber that was being used for lamp oil that was becoming increasingly expensive as whales were being basically whaled near to extinction. So they needed a replacement, and this was the sort of perfect technology for that. It ended up, as I say, vastly improving the lives of a lot of people who were able to light their homes much more cheaply than they would have if they were still relying on whale blubber. So that's why it became, I think, so important. It was such an important industry. It was really, in many ways, one of the most important industries that has ever happened, being really one of the underlying parts of the key part of the Industrial Revolution.
And, of course, as he acquires more wealth and power within the industry, and like you said, at this point of the game, although he's slowly establishing his dominance, the price of lighting oil is dropping for the consumer.
That's right. So I don't recall the exact prices, but there's no doubt that the price went down considerably after the sort of the initial craze of the oil boom sort of took off when Colonel Edwin Drake struck oil in 1859. That was really the beginning of the boom. And at that point, it was a very disorganized thing, and prices were obviously high because there was just no infrastructure for it. But the consolidation of that infrastructure through the monopolization that Standard Oil represented was, again, it did provide that dropping of the price for the consumer at that level.
And it's this point that he develops what he called our plan through the South Improvement Company, and this is where he seeks to destroy the independent oil men and come to dominate the industry.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. So it was around the time of the incorporation in 1870. Okay. He was quite highly leveraged at that point. He was deeply indebted to the banks that had forwarded the money for that incorporation and for the really getting Standard Oil off the ground, and that's exactly when his plan started to come to fruition, where he was going to use, obviously, deals with the railroads and a lot of secret subterfuge, where he would buy out competition, but then he would continue operating them as if they were competition. He wouldn't announce the merger or the deal, so then they could go out and buy other competition for him, and no one would know that it was him buying it all up so that he could get it at, you know, cheaper price. And this all culminated in I can't remember what it was called, the Cleveland disaster or something, some Cleveland calamity or something like that, where he ended up consolidating most of the Cleveland refinery in just a period of months. And after that point, it was pretty much assured that Standard Oil was going to be the monopoly in the United States.
Now, again, he's doing this within the industry, within the business itself. So the people he's hurting are his competition. But still, at this point, the vast majority of the American people are benefiting from his business acumen, you could say, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Right. I mean, at the end of the day, the consumer really just sees the dropping price and probably doesn't understand the dangers of giving one company,
yeah,
headed by this one man, such an incredible amount of control and power and money.
Which, again, it really becomes a problem, because I know his success in the industry attracted a lot of criticism because he was known as very, very ruthless and, you know, vicious businessman. I don't know if that means he was involved in any illegality. That's up for speculation.
Exactly right. I mean, we should be clear that one of the groundbreaking sort of works at the time was by Ida Tarbell, who wrote this expose that was wildly popular came out around the turn of the century.
And who was her father?
Yes, her father was one of the men who was crushed by Rockefeller, and he was one of the ones that most of the time when he was taking over these competitors, he would offer them some sort of deal,
yeah,
you know, for Standard Oil stock. And if they accepted it, generally, because Standard Oil obviously became what it became, they ended up, you know, very rich themselves. Her father ended up not taking that deal, so got completely crushed and torn apart. So she, I assume, had a personal axe to grind.
Yeah.
But she did write this expose that, again, was extremely popular and really did help to shape public perception of Standard Oil and John D. Rockefeller, very much to the negative, around the turn of the century. And she found some things that were certainly questionable, and as you say, there is questions as to whether it was strictly illegal at the time. But at any rate, in 1910, of course, the Supreme Court ultimately did rule that the Standard Oil was a monopoly, and so they tried to bust it up. And of course, we all know how that worked out. It worked out beautifully for John D. and the other Standard Oil stockholders.
Yeah, at the very time they're passing antitrust legislation, they're also practicing severe protective tariff laws, which of course encourages monopoly within the United States because it snuffs out competition. But that's politics, you know.
Exactly right. And it worked exactly the way it always does, and from their perspective always should. It benefited the few at the top.
And I believe the Sherman Antitrust Act, wasn't he brother of William Tecumseh Sherman?
You may be right about that. I'm not sure. Yeah.
The one who helped establish political monopoly within the United States.
Yeah, exactly.
By crushing the South. But that's a whole other issue. But because if it's very easy to paint this man as a villain, but really what he is, he's a very farseeing, very ingenious, very risk-taking. He has a lot of guts in business. So he's taking a lot of personal risk at first. But he wins out. He becomes dominant within the industry. And at that point, it becomes more problematic because he starts to leverage his wealth politically, and he becomes instead of just being a baron within the industry, he starts to become an oligarch, and there's a distinction there. But across the ocean, of course, his success is creating competition. Correct.
Well, of course, yes. Yeah. I mean, obviously, an industry like that is not going to arise without some degree of competition. So I think the American monopoly, as we say, was pretty firmly established and fairly quickly. But the internationally, there was still a lot of room for other companies to arise. So one of them that did arise in that early stage in the late 19th century actually, it started out as two companies. There was the Royal Dutch Oil Company, Petroleum Company, that was founded with a grant from the King of the Netherlands, King William III at the time. Quickly taken over by Queen Wilhelmina, who ended up becoming the world's first female billionaire, or at least admitted female billionaire, because of her business acumen, including her holdings in what became Royal Dutch Shell. The other half of that was the Shell Transport and Trading Company. It was first established by Marcus Samuel Sr., but ultimately Marcus Samuel, I believe, Jr., took over the company and was running it by the time of the late 1800s, where the Shell Transport Company basically became the shipping company for the Rothschilds, who, along with the Nobels, had moved into the Caucasus region, which was opening up the Russian nobility had opened it up to private development, private petroleum development in the 1870s. And so the Nobels and the Rothschilds moved in there immediately, the French Rothschilds, and they started to really squeeze out the competition there. And so then the Rothschilds hired Marcus Samuel to get their Caspian oil out into East Asian markets, which at the time were being pursued by the Rockefellers and Standard Oil. But there was still, as I say, a great room for competition there. And Marcus Samuel managed to do what no one had done to that point, which was build a oil tanker which could meet the standards of the Suez Canal Company, which controlled a passage through the Suez Canal. And they successfully did that. They've sailed the first tanker called the Murex through the canal in 1892. And that was a huge feat, a huge coup, really, for that what became Royal Dutch Shell in the early 1900s. So basically, the Royal Dutch Petroleum Company, which was also developing petroleum deposits in Borneo along with Shell, they basically saw the writing on the wall with Standard Oil and decided to merge. It took a few years. There was a couple of different sort of intermediate companies, but in 1907, they became Royal Dutch Shell. And so it was the Rothschild Nobel Caspian Oil that was really the underlying part of that. So the Rothschilds did hold shares in the Asiatic Petroleum Company, which was one of those intermediary companies before Royal Dutch Shell. And then when Royal Dutch Shell was created, it becomes murkier. But to this day, it is still believed that the Rothschilds and the Dutch royal family are two of the major shareholders in Shell, what is today Royal Dutch Shell.
And, of course, in Persia, you have the British making their mark.
Yes, exactly right. So in the early part of the 20th century, in 1901, there was a socialite, William Knox Darcy, who managed to secure a concession from the King of Persia, which was just incredible, an incredible coup. It was exclusive rights to prospect for oil throughout the entire country for 60 years. And he spent 7 years funding a search through Persia for oil, seven fruitless years where they were not striking anything. And they got to the point in 1908 where Darcy and his backers and co-investors sent a telegram to their geologists telling them, stop, you know, dismantle your equipment, come home. You're not going to find anything. And he disobeyed that order, and he just kept drilling. And it was really just weeks after he got that telegram that he struck oil and what was to become an extremely lucrative find. And so the Burma Oil moniker that they were going on under was spun off. That particular Persian oil concession was spun off as Anglo-Persian Oil Company. And the British government ended up taking majority control of the company's shares in 1914. And the Anglo-Persian Oil Company eventually became British Petroleum. So that represents the British crown, basically. To this day, I think BP is still an extension of British foreign policy and foreign power.
So what you have here in the United States, you have people from relatively modest means creating their own empire, financial empire, and becoming powerful that way, which is, you could say, more of the American way, we'd like to think.
Yeah. It fits the narrative anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Of course, in Europe, you have, the British, you have royal families.
British royalty, Dutch royalty, and the unofficial Rothschild royalty.
And it's more top down, I guess you could say, than.
Yes. And certainly old world established wealth. Yeah. Yeah.
But at some point or another, the Rockefellers become powerful enough to become, I guess, amongst them, you know. So you have this. We have the creation of the oil giants by the early 20th century. British Petroleum, Royal Dutch Shell, and I guess you could have the various companies. Standard Oil eventually became Exxon Mobil, Esso, as it got broken up and all that, you know. Eventually, you had Texaco, but now they're the, I think it used to be the Seven Sisters. Now they're down to three now. So in fact,
yeah, it's been winnowing down, but basically it's just mergers. Yeah. But I believe Texaco came from Spindletop, which wasn't Standard Oil.
Yeah, which was interesting. Yeah, because just when his monopoly was as peak, Spindletop went off.
Yeah.
But of course that had an effect in making. Eventually would make gasoline more marketable, which had an effect on the industry itself.
Well, it brought the price of gasoline down to the point where there was no question anymore between gasoline as a fuel for automotives and alcohol, which had been toyed with as a fuel. And there was a point in America where alcohol was available for fuel at a cheaper rate than gasoline. But that didn't last very long, as the Spindletop wells, including 100,000 barrels a day, started coming online. Then that just pushed the price down to the point where there was no question that gasoline was going to win out. And certainly with some of the underhanded tricks that played out from that point, with as I go on to detail in the documentary, with Rockefeller supporting the prohibition movement, maybe not for the virtuous reasons that he wanted to project in public.
Yeah, it's the old bootleggers of Baptist
yeah, that old merger.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, this is where you state in the documentary that at this point it's nowhere clear that oil will become the dominant energy source. There's still competition. But then again, as you said in a section, you say competition is a sin. This is where, as you alluded to with prohibition, where Rockefeller starts to, I guess, leverage his wealth politically to affect policies that don't directly affect oil, but do, because with prohibition, wasn't there a banned alcohol for consumption? Didn't ban it for energy,
yeah.
But it required an additive.
Yes, exactly.
Made it no longer competitive.
Right. So to give people the background on this, ethyl alcohol had been used as lamp fuel and engine fuel since the early 19th century. So it was an established competitor to petroleum, petroleum byproducts and gasoline. And so there had been a lot of work with that. And although, I mean, people will probably bring up alcohol has a lower heat value than gasoline, so it requires more energy to burn. But because of the higher compression ratio in alcohol engines, you could actually offset the lower heat value. So actually, there was a study in 1908 by the USGS and US Navy that found that they were equivalent. Alcohol engines and gasoline engines were fuel economy equivalent because of that offsetting the higher compression ratio. So it was a viable technology. And as I say, there was a brief point at which ethyl alcohol was available at a cheaper price in the United States than gasoline. It was a very brief window, but still it was at least feasible for some time that there was going to be competition. And that's, I mean, one of the things that people might have forgotten is that the original Model T was designed to be run on either gasoline or alcohol, because Henry Ford was a supporter of alcohol fuel. In fact, he thought that the idea was extremely important for the sort of independent American farmer that he thought was extremely important to the American economy overall. So his vision, as he told the New York Times, I believe in the 1920s, he said the fuel of the future is going to come from fruit like that sumac out on the road, or from apples, weed, sawdust, almost anything. There is fuel in every bit of vegetable matter that can be fermented. So his vision was this very, very, very different vision of the fuel of the future, which was going to be this very distributed, impossible to monopolize thing that you could literally grow, you know, anywhere. Anyone could grow it. And if the infrastructure was there, presumably they could grow it and make it into ethyl alcohol fuel for cars or whatever else fairly cheaply. But that infrastructure ultimately did not get put in place. As you say, one of the reasons was Spindletop making gasoline cheaper. But one of the other reasons was, as you say, during Prohibition. Although in 1906, there was an alcohol tax that had been on the books since the Civil War to help pay for the Civil War. But we all know how those taxes tend to persist after their supposed mandate. And so by 1906, finally, it was repealed. So that brought ethanol down in price. But so almost immediately, the prohibition movement, which had been around for decades but had been kind of floundering and politically directionless, was really gaining momentum by that point. And it was gaining momentum specifically because of the Anti-Saloon League, which was started in Ohio, of course. Rockefeller's, not his home state, but his home base of operations for Standard Oil, and by his longtime personal friend Howard Hyde Russell. And John D. helped bankroll the Anti-Saloon League and lobbied for prohibition, and ultimately got it through. And one of the effects of prohibition was that ethyl alcohol as a fuel was still, you could still market it, but in order to do so, you had to add certain petroleum derivatives, ironically enough, in order to poison it, make it poisonous, so that you couldn't drink the fuel, basically. So that actually, I mean, interestingly enough, that ended up in this case that you can read about, where there were hundreds of poisonings, people literally dying during the prohibition because of things like that. That the prohibition included the prohibition on drinking of fuel alcohol, which again, was only accomplished through the adding of these derivatives. Mm-hmm. So basically, by that point, it was guaranteed that alcohol fuel was going to go by the wayside. And at that point, they just started looking at it as an additive to gasoline for to help prevent engine knock.
Yeah. That's this example of them using the political process to snuff out competition. And
yes.
And also, another good example, that's an early example of, say, AstroTurf activism.
Yes, exactly right. I mean, exactly yeah. right. And it's one of those things that it continues to be effective because, again, it does have a very visible, very obvious social side of it, but a very subtle and very indirect second side of it that people would generally never even consider until they start to really piece the puzzle together. And unfortunately, sometimes that can only be done in hindsight with the benefit of history.
And the same thing also was done with marijuana and hemp for the benefit of the petrochemical industry too, right?
DuPont. Of course, exactly.
Because hemp products would make rope, nylon, wanted to make nylon marketable, and they couldn't with available
exactly.
hemp.
And so that's whip up reefer madness and get yeah. people scared of it.
And that, of course, that has long-term consequences because a lot of the stuff that stores our food are in plastic, which are petrochemically based, laced with all types of chemicals, which have health effects. Whereas you could, if they were packaged in hemp, that wouldn't be the case. Even the clothing, by the way, if clothing were made by hemp as opposed to nylon, some say the nylon clothing has a long-term health effect on you. You know.
Well, people might remember that in the about a decade ago, there was the big brouhaha about BPA, mm-hmm. bisphenol A, one of the derivatives of which plastic is made from. And interestingly enough, that chemical, it was actually used as an estrogen mimicking compound. It was actually used medicinally in the 1930s. But for some reason, they decided to make it as one of the essential ingredients in a lot of different plastics, and even the sort of substance that lines food cans and things of that nature, even though they knew that it had those effects. And mm-hmm. then decades and decades and decades later, when the public starts to find out about it, it's all this, oh, who would have known? Oh, well, okay, we'll start withdrawing that. So I think, yeah, again, we can see darker agendas at play. It's just never, of course, going to be explicitly stated like mm-hmm. that.
Population control. So, here we're at a point now where they've made gasoline dominant. And of course, it's serendipity because they've perfected the internal combustion engine, and automobiles now are on the road. But then, you have in the 40s, you have they destroy the public transport system, the rail system, and there was a conspiracy behind that. Want to get into that?
Yes, and the long story short, GM, along with Standard Oil of California and Firestone and a few others businesses got into bed together in some buying up something called National City Lines, mm-hmm. which owned a number of different rail trolley car systems and lines in various cities. And basically they ended up buying up and scrapping transit systems, public electric transit systems in 45 cities. And they put What else would they put in their place? Of course, GM buses running on diesel powered from Standard Oil Petroleum. So this was a pretty clear cut case, and it did ultimately get litigated. And in 1947, they were in the National City Lines group consortium was indicted for conspiring to form a transportation monopoly. And in 1949, they were actually convicted on the second count of conspiring to monopolize sales of buses and supplies. And so, although they were actually convicted of this in federal court, their punishment was the lightest of light slaps on the wrist, a $5,000 fine. And in fact, the director of Pacific City Lines, which oversaw the Pacific Electric System in Los Angeles, this $100 million incredible public transportation infrastructure that was then scrapped by Pacific City Lines, he was personally fined $1. And that was really the judge making a statement, well, I don't think you guys are really that guilty, so you should get away with it, pretty much. And not surprisingly, who went on to become President Eisenhower's Secretary of Defense, it was the president of General Motors, Charles Wilson, who was the one who oversaw the creation of the Federal Interstate Highway System, which, of course, guaranteed that rail would not be a viable form of transport across America between cities. It was going to be dominated by the car and by the highway infrastructure, which, again, was paid for by the U.S. taxpayers for the benefit of GM and their buddies. So, again, it's just mind-boggling the level at which this is operating. But I think we have to start to pull out to see the bigger picture of what these players are going for, because we in the general public are generally stymied by a lack of imagination about how these business players really operate and what they're going for, which self-evidently is consolidation of as much control over as much of the market as they can possibly get.
It is sort of, there's an ironic twist to that. The death of the railroad was, you know, was political, because the creation of the railroad in the United States was very political.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, a lot of the robber barons in the 19th century made their fortunes through rail. And, they as long as you know which way the political winds are blowing, you can jump on the next bandwagon before it leads to the station.
These aren't market decisions that are being taken. These are, it's all political entrepreneurship, all insider dealings and taxpayer subsidies, and even the creation of airports and the airlines were all subsidized.
Of course,
you know, these weren't free market, ventures. They're all the blessings of the federal government for some sort of social engineering scheme. You know, so and that's the point here, because you mentioned the construction interstate highway system that ushers in the era that creates the automobile culture. It also facilitates the creation of suburbia, which changes the nation in many ways, demographically, politically, culturally. Creates, I guess you could say the bland middle class, the consumer culture. And I think people have done research in this know that this was always the plan. How some of the neighborhoods were designed, like Levittown and all that, And I think they were World War II engineers, I think, and they perfected mass, production of these homes, putting on these slabs real fast, but it changed the culture,
It certainly did, and it is important for us living as we do to even imagine that there was a different culture in America at some point. I mean, it's just so ingrained in the cultural imagination by this point that it even permeated down into Canada, where we watched all of your media secondhand, America is a car culture.
The automobile
cars all the time. It's all about the federalization of the car.
And one other thing, you get into geopolitics, which I think was very fascinating, because you mentioned the Baghdad, the Berlin Railroad, and I guess the control of oil and how that's led to, I could argue that it led to the 30 years war between Britain and Germany.
Right. I wouldn't say that the Berlin-Baghdad Railway was the cause of World War One, but I think it shouldn't be overlooked as an exceptionally important contributor to the German-British rivalry that was going on at the turn of the century. It was extremely important. So for people who don't know, in 1889, Deutsche Bank led a consortium of German investors that managed to obtain a concession from the Turkish government, which at the time had control over Persia and Mesopotamia, Iraq. Mesopotamia. And they managed to secure a concession for the building of a railway line from Berlin all the way down to Basra on the Gulf. And of course, that would go through Baghdad. So it was the Berlin-Baghdad Railway. And it was a 99-year concession with mineral rights for 20 kilometers on either side of the line. So you have this 40-kilometer swath cutting right through what would become some of the most productive oil wells in the world. Of course, it wasn't known at that time, but it was suspected. And certainly, this became a huge point of contention. And it's interesting to see, ultimately, I mean, I think at the end of the day, we could say that problem, quote unquote, was solved, quote unquote, by World War One and the British basically wiping out Germany and taking over all of that area and breaking up the Ottoman Empire and taking over the steaming remains. But one of the things that they were doing behind the scenes, even before World War One started, was to try to move in on that concession and to try to consolidate control over that that area. So basically, they moved in with their agents in Turkey. There was this group of London bankers that created the Turkish National Bank. which you would think was Turkish, but no, it was actually, I mean, it was essentially a British creation. And it was Sir Edward Castle and Hugo Baring and all of these British bankers who founded this Turkish National Bank, which I believe did have power to issue the Turkish currency. So again, just control over banking is control over politics, basically. Mm-hmm. And they managed to create a deal for the oil concessions in that area of Mesopotamia. And they basically strong-armed the Deutsche Bank consortium into a partnership where they took a junior cut of the deal that also included, of course, their mineral rights concessions along the Berlin-Baghdad Railway. And so these bankers had already basically taken over the deal before World War I even broke out. But, I mean, the most ironic part of it all is that the final negotiations for Iraqi oil concessions with the Turkish government concluded on June 28, 1914, the day that Archduke Ferdinand was shot and World War I, you know, supposedly started. I mean, that is an incredible, one of those incredible historical coincidences that really does shed some light into what's really maybe what the real start of World War I was about.
Yeah, because if, of course, he was shot by Gavriela Princip, who's a member of the Black Hand, who
yes.
some say links back to British intelligence and British Freemasonry.
Certainly some secret society connections going on there.
And that goes back to, to understand, you have to understand the British geostrategy of the Mackinder Doctrine. And that's where the sea power has to control the Eurasia.
Right. Yeah. And exactly right. And if Berlin, the Berlin-Baghdad Railway went ahead and Germany had that direct access right down all the way to the mm-hmm. Gulf, the threat to naval power, British naval power in that region was obvious. I mean, you have the direct ability to supply, and even if they wanted to send troops down into the region or whatever, and that was the type of lifeline that Britain was very, very scared of with this rising Germany, which is why it had to be put down.
And which and we see that today with the political jockeying between the Anglo-American power, the Atlanticist powers, versus this, I guess you could say, this nascent alliance between China, Russia, and possibly even Europe. You know, this,
yes.
You know,
yes. I don't know if alliance is the right word. I don't know what you call it.
But yeah.
Yeah. Some sort of grouping, consortium.
Yeah.
Uneasy at times, but certainly the idea is there, and we see it reflected in various things. And I mean, we have on the Putin side, we have the Eurasian Economic Union, and then on the Xi Jinping side, we have the one road, one belt policy of China and their attempts to try to connect the region.
But it's very similar because you get Britain at the time of 1914 was this sort of this industrial power in a relative decline. Germany and Russia are on the rise. And so how do you knock them down a peg to maintain your dominance? You could say the same thing applies to the United States and Atlantic powers today. And you can if you look at China, if you look at Russia, you look at Europe, Europe's technical know-how, Russia's natural resources, and China's factories. Why do they need the United States? So that's part of the geopolitical jockey. But it's funny how there's things still – this conflict, you know, a century ago, we still see the same – you could say the same issues arising today, different faces, but it's the same.
Yeah, but I see an exact parallel, actually, between the lead up to World War I and what's happening right now. And I think to a certain extent that's been engineered and allowed to happen and is being used as in the same way World War I and World War II was used to shape the course of 20th century politics. I think we're going to be steered into a conflict to shape the course of 21st century politics.
And I guess you cite him in your documentary, but a good source in that is William Engdahl.
Yes, of course.
These intrigues and geopolitical jockeying. To read his books, you'll get a good idea of what's going on here. You certainly won't get it by watching the news media. So
no,
but then we shoot ahead to the post-war era. I think you phrased it perfectly in your documentary. You say just as the Rockefellers supplemented their oil fortune by going into banking, and the Rothschilds supplemented their banking fortune by going into oil. By going into oil.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think at that point, once it's about the oligarchy, rather than about the industrial concerns of it, I think it goes from being about wealth to being about power. And I think that's really what it represents at that level. The Rockefellers went into banking because that's where the power was, and the Rothschilds helped to consolidate oil because that's where the power was.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you have World War II occurs. Of course, we all know the outcome of that. Europe's destroyed industrially for a decade or so. and you have the creation of the Bretton Woods system, which is this kind of this gold exchange standard, very similar to the system that existed in the 20s, right after World War One, which collapsed eventually too, for similar reasons.
Well, with an important difference though, in that it enshrined the U.S. dollar really as the sort of gold standard, because the dollar itself was supposed to be pegged at $35 an ounce.
Yeah.
So really, it was all structured specifically to make the U.S. dollar the key linchpin of the world international monetary system.
But this lasts a mere 27 years. Want to explain why? And it gets us into 1973, the oil shocks.
In some ways, you could say it lasted less than 27 years, because there was already considerable strains on the system by the 1960s. It was all but a foregone conclusion that it was going to formally wrap up. And eventually, it did formally wrap up in August of 71, when Nixon formally declared an end to the gold window. He closed the gold window so that people couldn't redeem the dollar for the $35 an ounce that was mandated under the Bretton Woods system. And since the entire system was structured on that, I mean, that created a pretty, I mean, at least you had the sort of notion that existed before that point, that there was some sort of notional backing to the international monetary system. But once that happened, I mean, it was just great chaos. So basically, the story is that the U.S., since the U.S. dollar was the reserve currency, because it was pegged to gold at $35 an ounce, and other currencies were pegged or floated in exchange with the U.S. dollar, the U.S. dollar in a way had to act in a dual function, in a paradoxical function that's been pointed out by economists. One, it has to be widely spread enough and produced enough to underlie the entire global exchange system, but it also has to be stewarded over and kept under control so that you don't print too much, so that it doesn't devalue the currency. And whatever the balance in between those paradoxical forces are, clearly the U.S. wasn't doing that in the 1960s, as they started to ramp up in Vietnam and the spending started to get completely out of control. So you got a number of countries that really started to worry about the system and started effectively cashing out. You had Germany and France trying to redeem their dollars for gold, and other countries. And it came to a point where the Federal Reserve was just not going to be able to cover those claims anymore. So in 71, Nixon ended that system and said, you know, well, okay, you can't get gold for dollars anymore. But that, of course, as I say, left this huge, big question mark right in the center of international monetary system, which is, well, OK, so what do we do now? What is really backing this up? We're still structured in this way that the U.S. dollar is the sort of default global reserve currency. But why? And, you know, what's going to prevent the United States from just printing billions and trillions and quadrillions of them? And why would we continue buying them? So that was really a sort of open question that hung out there for a few years. But not to fear, the oligarchs had their own plan for that.
And this, we have the Yom Kippur War, which was, which apparently was planned in the spring of 73, right?
Well, let's dwell on this for a moment.
Yeah.
Because in the spring of 73, in May 73 specifically, there was the Bilderberg meeting. I'm sure most of your listeners will have at least heard of this. Of course, a high-level meeting Bilderberg Group was founded in 1954 by Prince Bernard of the Netherlands, a.k.a. part of that Royal Dutch Shell family. And it includes all of the uppermost of the British, European, American business, financial elite, as well as royalty, as well as industrial and media figures. I mean, it's obviously quite an exclusive club. Their meetings have been held in almost complete 100% secrecy for decades and decades. It's only in recent years that it's really started to receive any attention, and as a result, probably has become less important. But anyway, in May 1973, they convened in Sweden, I believe. And in that meeting, they were in great detail, which we now know of because the meeting minutes are available. They've been leaked online. You can go and read them. In great detail, they were discussing oil from all sorts of different perspectives. In the European case, their idea of trying to consolidate some sort of organization for combating potential for price control from the oil petroleum exporting countries, OPEC. From the American perspective, of course, they have their own plans that aren't necessarily in line with Europe. They were talking about Japan and some of the players in the East and how they were playing into this. But one of the things that they were discussing at great length was the possibility of an energy crisis. And specifically in those documents, they were talking about oil prices going up to between $10 and $12 per barrel as a result of an oil crisis, which is strange because in spring of 73, there wasn't at least any particular trigger for such a crisis. I guess the mechanism was really there with OPEC and the growing clout of the producer nations, but there was no particular trigger for an impending energy crisis. But then, of course, later that year, the Yom Kippur War kicks off, and by October, OPEC is raising the rates. By December, they raise the rates again to $11.65 a barrel, right directly in that sweet spot, that 400% increase that the Bilderbergers were talking about in May of that year. So all of that, I mean, you know, regardless of exactly how it was engineered, it certainly did come about exactly as they had predicted. And as William Engdahl reports, the Saudi King Faisal, his personal emissary, had specifically asked the Shah of Iran why he had demanded that particular price, a staggering 70% rise in oil prices from October and then 400% in December. And the Shah of Iran apparently, reportedly, told this emissary, tell your king if he wants to know the answer to this question, he should go to Washington and ask Henry Kissinger, who, of course, is Rockefeller's minion, who, of course, both of them were at that May 1973 meeting. So, again, that's highly convenient. And really, the upshot of this is that not only do they have the oil crisis, which, of course, for the oil majors isn't particularly a problem. They just pass on the high prices to consumers. But it also created the space for a sickly, diabolically brilliant secondary move by Kissinger, which was to construct the petrodollar. And basically, that is a deal with Saudi Arabia that exists to some extent and some form to this day, that as long as the Saudis would price all of their oil sales in dollars, i.e. creating a constant demand for U.S. dollars, because there is a constant demand for oil, then we'll protect you, we'll sell you arms, we'll do all that, you know, we'll be your man in the region. And the other part of that deal was, of course, all of those dollars that you're getting for your oil sales, you'll recycle back through the U.S., you'll buy U.S. treasuries through U.S. banks, including, of course, the Chase Bank, headed by David Rockefeller himself at that time. So, again, win-win-win-win-win for the oligarchy, and lose-lose-lose for most of humanity.
So a vast pool of credit is open up to the Treasury Department.
Exactly right. They get to print as much money as they need to go do their foreign wars of aggression, mm-hmm. and it's all backed up by the global dependence on oil.
And you also get this 400% increase in the price of oil, which automatically overnight converts a lot of these exploration deals, makes them profitable, like the North Sea and also the Alaskan pipeline, if I believe, at the time.
Yes, yes, that's exactly right. And that's such an important point, and one that really struck me in the research for this documentary that I don't think I had the chance to really convey. I was thinking, and probably still will do another episode on the idea of peak oil, but something that comes across very clearly to people who have studied the history of this, that there are people right from the very beginning of the oil industry, I mean, really from the 1860s and 70s onward, there are no shortage of quotes about people worrying there's too much oil, we're pumping too much oil, there's not going to be a market, there's way too much oil coming online. Over and over and over throughout the history of oil, this has been one of the primary concerns is, oh, there's too much oil, we have to get the prices up. And they found a way to do that time and time again through various geopolitical machinations, economic machinations, you name it. But they've managed to do that. So although, of course, oil has been going down for the last couple of years, I think we've definitely seen some of that in our own lifetimes with some of the extremely high prices we've seen in the recent past. Mm-hmm.
And of course, this factors also into a particular sinister document, which is National Security Study Memorandum 200 by Henry Kissinger, 1974.
Yes, that's right. The genocidal plan to basically make food aid and other types of aid contingent on population control in various third world countries that are targeted for population reduction.
And these, I guess you could say these oil shocks were integral to that plan, weren't they?
Yes. I mean, they certainly did impinge on some of the areas, some of the oil areas, oil dependent areas that were suddenly going to be, you know, scrambling for to try to import enough energy to keep their economies going while trying to feed and clothe their populations. And that put them in a position where they were extraordinarily reliant on food aid and other types of aid coming from the U.S., which, again, was going to be tied up with all of these strings to do with population control. Mm-hmm. And that's not even to mention the Food for Peace program.
Mm-hmm. Which opens up all types of demands using it gets into, I guess you could say, their vision for the world, the next part of the the world in their image. Yeah. But then earlier on, you have things like the General Education Board, where Rockefeller, I think, donates $180 million to change American education.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So really, this part of the documentary, The World in Their Image, is talking about the way that that wealth and that consolidation of control over the oil industry was parlayed into general power and control over the rest of society. And it's fascinating to look at that, because this is really a case study in how power is centralized, how it functions, how it can be amplified and extended across every field of human activity, which, again, you'd have to be a particular sort of person to even try to wrap your head around doing something like this. But anyway, apparently those people exist, and I think it's better that we look that squarely in the face. So really, the first part of this is the restitution of John D. Rockefeller's image in the public eye, which, as I say, by the time of Ida Tarbell and the types of press that John D. was getting in the run-up to the breakup of Standard Oil, it was atrocious. His name was dragged through the mud. He was looked upon as one of the key enemies of humanity. And so he literally, in a sense, created the PR industry. He hired Ivy Lee, who is really looked on as one of the founders of the modern PR industry, to restore his image. And they did all sorts of ridiculous tricks. They gave out dimes to orphans and caught that on camera. Oh, you know, candid camera. Oh, look, it's John D. Rockefeller giving out dimes. That kind of thing.
Candid camera, 1920.
Yeah, exactly. Let's just set up this camera and we'll have a spontaneous. Anyway, so it was pretty transparent, but it worked. And a lot of people started to see the reform. But really, the key of this reform started with education. That was the first thing that Rockefeller went after. Because as in our own time, I think it's quite obvious, as long as you talk about, oh, you know, won't someone think of the children? Let's give more money to schools. Almost no one is going to say that's a bad thing. Everyone wants that. Everyone, of course, wants children to be educated. So how else do you do that other than through the public schooling system? And so the real first move in this was the creation of the University of Chicago, which John D. Rockefeller primarily funded into existence. And from that point, he consolidated a crew that, including Frederick Taylor Gates and others, that would go on to become his go-to men in the creation of what would become a sort of philanthropical monopoly that he was putting together. And so one of the first forerunner organizations of that was the General Education Board. As you say, it was it created, I believe, in 1902 and endowed with $180 million. And let's keep in mind, that's 1902 dollars. $180 million, we're talking billions equivalent today. I mean, just a staggering amount of money to throw at the education system generally. And of course, it was not for wonderful, beneficial, you know, let's make everyone bright scholars who can think for themselves. Of course, it was for their own ulterior purposes. And I do quote in the documentary that quote from Frederick Taylor Gates, who wrote in one of the works that he expounded his idea, The Country School of Tomorrow, which again sounds like this wonderful thing that this wonderful General Education Board is giving all this money to. But in that, he specifically says, in our dream, we have limitless resources, and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hand. The present educational conventions fade from our minds, and unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon a grateful and responsive folk. We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or science. We are not to raise from among them authors, orators, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for embryo great artists, painters, musicians, nor will we cherish even the humbler ambition to raise up from among them lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, statesmen, of whom we now have ample supply. So, of course, the question is, well, what are they doing? And the question is, they are creating pliant workers for the industrial concerns of the industrial monopolists who are funding these very programs. And it doesn't take a great deal of imagination to even wrap your mind around that concept, because that's quite obvious that that's exactly why they would spend so much of their time and money and effort and resources into shaping the schooling system, is to make more compliant workers. Ultimately, the product of the schooling system are these people who are going to come out the other side with a certain worldview and a certain conditioning. And of course, now we can look at it from our side and understand what that conditioning is and how it has been instituted to the point where most people take it for granted. But if people do take it for granted and don't really understand how the schooling system really shapes us into obedient workers, a good place to start would, of course, be the works of John Taylor Gatto, including maybe the best starting point would be his resignation letter, where he resigned in the editorial pages of the New York Times to some degree of fanfare, where he laid out what it was that he did as a teacher, which was basically to train people to, you know, to accept him and his final arbiter of authority, and to accept that they are ranked and graded and sorted into, you know, future life professions by the teachers in the school system. And they're trained to respond to bells and to drop tasks at a moment notice, and all of these things, which are in some ways, I guess, subtle, in some ways quite blatant in terms of the way that they prepare us for the world. But this ultimately can be traced back to the Rockefeller and Carnegie influence. Both Rockefeller and Carnegie were instrumental in shaping our modern conception of schooling and making that Prussian model of education, coming from Prussia in the late 19th century, the standard in the American school system.
And today you can see that same spirit in Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, their support of Common Core.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And I think there are so many parallels between the Rockefeller story and the various stories of the sort of new, not oligarchs, now they're, I don't know what to call them, technogarchs, but Bill Gates as a shining example of exactly how these families buy their way into that oligarchical circle and exactly what they do with it. And as you say, Bill and Melinda Gates absolutely spending a lot of their money in trying to shape the American education, well, the American education system around the globe, but of course, starting in America, and trying to bring all of these technologies to bear in ways that they can now, they're starting to try to monitor students at all times and through technological means as a way of making the technological control grid even that much more advanced. And then, of course, you look at other examples of the technogarchs like Mark Zuckerberg, and he's of course name dropping Henry Kissinger as one of his heroes and someone he's going to be looking up to as he starts his Zuckerberg initiative, which of course is just clearly modeled after the Rockefeller Foundation model of taking your vast, unbelievable fortune and putting it in this tax exempt foundation for quote unquote charity purposes, even though you explicitly are saying you're going to use it mostly for investment. And of course, you just use it to shape the world in your image. Again, I think they're just following a template here, and the template was established really by the Rockefellers.
Yeah, you mentioned the foundation strategy, the creation of these tax-free foundations, because in your documentary, you talk about how Carnegie and Rockefeller, their respective foundations, got together. I guess the Reese Committee, you mentioned their investigation, the Reese Committee, and Norman Dodd, the investigator, how he exposed the plan to, I guess, impose collectivism on the country through the foundations by taking over things like history, the teaching of history. And, of course, you think of Orwell's, that those who control the past control the future. And there was a specific plan to change the way history was taught in the United States with the creation of various endowments, I guess you could say. And you could actually change the way people look at the past. And also you mentioned University of Chicago, which I think developed sociology as a science, as a discipline, correct?
Yes, exactly. No, entire academic disciplines truly did come from these foundations and the work that they were doing. And as you say, history was the first place where they really started to consolidate their control through the various grants that they used and the scholarships and the Rhodes Scholars and Fulbright and all of that, working together to try to create a cadre of people who would be susceptible to teaching their version of history. And again, they became these these scholars that they funded became the nucleus of the American Historical Association, which was granted $400,000 in the late part of the 1920s, specifically by the Carnegies and Rockefellers, to put forward that teaching of history that was compliant and in tune with the narrative that they wanted people to understand about the country.
Now, we started this interview talking about Devil Bill, William Avery Rockefeller, and his selling of snake oil. And in your documentary, you talk about how they took over medicine. The Rockefeller.
Yes.
I know I don't. I might want to be respectful of your time. We're coming up over an hour now, but I would like to get into medicine.
Yes, let's keep going. It's an important subject.
Okay, good. I just don't want to make sure I'm not interrupting or getting in the way of some other engagement you have.
Okay.
So medicine. Okay. That's an amazing story because that's one of the situations where we've been so conditioned to accept the medical the paradigm of the medical doctor, allopathic care as medicine, and anything else is quackery. So how'd that happen?
That, again, is one of those things that as I was working on it, I thought this really should be its entirely own documentary unto itself, because, again, there's just so much information here. But it's quite astounding when you look at the creation of our modern conception of medical care and how directly tied into these same foundations that concept is. And I guess you could say that the sort of coming together of the American Medical Association in the late part of the 19th century was an extremely important stepping stone there, which was connected and did have connections to the Rockefellers, Carnegies, those kinds of movers and shakers. But the most direct and obvious step along that path was the issuing of the Flexner Report in 1910. And the Flexner Report it was extremely influential. It was created by Simon Flexner, who was the brother of Abraham Flexner, who was an educator for the Carnegie Foundation. Anyway, this Simon Flexner, funded by the Carnegies, ultimately going on to work for the Rockefeller Foundation, came out with this report that was looking at the question specifically of the American medical college system, medical training, how it was conducted in the United States, and found, it's just a total mess. There's no set standards for how we train doctors or what constitutes a doctor or how people get this title. And so you have this vast disparity between different regions and different schools. And it basically, what we need to do is come along and consolidate this and make sure there's some sort of standardized system so we can have some, reliable product of doctors. And so they started to, on the basis of the Flexner Report, a bunch of medical colleges throughout the United States were closed down and consolidated. And the ones that remained were, of course, the ones that were being funded by the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and those types of foundation funding. And through that system, by consolidating control over the way doctors are trained, and of course then ultimately the licensing of what it means to be a doctor through the American Medical Association, through that power control that comes from that funding level, they were able to consolidate the what it means to practice medicine, what a doctor is and what he does. And as you say, in the late 19th century, there was a vast array of different types of doctors that you could go to. And allopathic doctors were only one type, and they were not particularly popular because the tools at their disposal at that time were, downright barbaric. Go for surgery in the late 19th century and, good luck. Take a swig of whiskey and bite on a bullet while they, cut you open and hope you don't die. It was quite, barbaric and nightmarish. So allopaths weren't necessarily looked on as great, stewards of the human body. So the time-honored tradition at that time, of course, was homeopathy, naturopaths, people using medicines and herbs that had been around for hundreds or thousands of years to stimulate the immune system more so than to cut and burn and, the disease itself. But as I say, with the consolidation of control over the colleges and over the licensing, you start to ingrain this idea that, no, the only doctors are allopaths and the only way to do it is surgery and radiation and these types of things, which became the standardized system that we know of today. And just so happens, happily enough for the oligarchs, that system is based on pharmaceuticals, which are largely often derived from petrochemical products themselves. So again, you have another way through the back door that the oligarchs are making money off of this philanthropy that they're doing, trying to set up the standardization of the medical industry. And I mean, as I say, there's so many different aspects to this. Not only, I mean, Standard Oil, for example, spinning off Nujol and things like that, but much more insidiously, the ways that treatments can be brought in that are as much a part of the problem as the cure. And so, for example, one of the things that I point to in the documentary, most people don't know chemotherapy comes from the development of various types of chemical weapons. Mustard gas was one of the primary focuses of research of Cornelius Rhodes, who was a U.S. Army pathologist who was doing research on into mustard gas. And he just turned around and took that research that he was doing and went to became an employee of the Sloan Kettering Cancer Institute, which, of course, had Rockefeller money. And he, as a Rockefeller Institute pathologist, took that mustard gas research and turned it into chemotherapy. Hey, we'll cure your cancer with this mustard gas. So, again, a lot of people don't know of these types of connections, but they run extremely deep. And I think one of the more interesting ones that, again, ties into the geopolitical side of it is IG Farben, which was that German pharmaceutical/petrochemical industrial consortium that came about in the early 20th century, which of course was populated by the usual oligarchs, Prince Bernhard connected with them. And then in America, I mean, literally run by Walter Teagle of Standard Oil and Paul Warburg, of course, one of the Rothschilds agents in the United States. So again, it connects directly into the same interests. And IG Farben, just like Standard Oil, was broken up after World War II, but just like Standard Oil, it really just maintained its position in its various offshoots. And of course, to this day, BASF is the largest chemical company in the world. It is one of the IG Farben offshoots. And then Bayer and Sanofi, which people probably know as pharmaceutical companies, again, they were offshoots of the IG Farben concern. So again, it ties directly back to the same oligarchical interests. And when you look at the major, not just the research foundations, which of course get all their money from the Rockefellers and those types of family foundations, but even the boards of these pharmaceutical companies are generally populated by people who have various Rockefeller and other connected interests.
And Chris, with that, you mentioned licensing, but key to this is the suppression, the legal suppression, the brutal suppression of alternative innovative care.
Yes. I mean, when we talk about licensing, I hope people can understand and read for the relatively benign word licensing. What that means is you are implying the threat of violence against people who do not, you know, concede to your licensing scheme. So when you say, you know, let's license hairdressers, what you're saying is if you give a haircut without getting a license from the state, we're going to use force on you if necessary to get you to stop, which is, I mean, if they put it in those terms, it's a ridiculous, horrific idea. But if they say, oh no, we're licensing to make it standardized so you get a, you know, a standardized product, it sounds so much better. And of course, that's the exact way in which the control and the shaping of the medical oligarchy itself came together. And I think there's no end to examples that we could look at ways that people are prosecuted for things that is just mind-boggling that the government should have any control over the ways that people, you know, treat their own bodies. But again, it's all done under the guise of philanthropy and licensing and other benign sounding institutions like that,
or how they cover up how many people die by the hands of their doctor every year, you know. So
yes. Yeah. I forget what the number is, but it's in the hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands, and that's from what I understand, is a generous estimate.
Because, a conservative estimate.
Yeah, conservative by that. It's iatrogenic death, I think it's called, like the word. Iatrogenic, I think, is the word. But yeah, you get so they take over medicine, impose this paradigm. It basically, it redounds to the benefit of the petrochemical industry. But now you get into finance as well. How in 1910, the little meeting down at Jekyll Island.
Yes, a little meeting down in Jekyll Island, really spearheaded and put together by the man who just happened to be John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s father-in-law. And of course, surrounded by not just the oligarchical interests, although they're there, Paul Warburg, again, essential in that meeting, but also JP Morgan interests meeting there in Jekyll Island. And what they're working on is the problem of how to create a central bank for the United States, which had been central bankless since the 1840s.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
For the most part, yeah, 1840.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the time frame here. But yes, since
Andrew Jackson
killed the bank.
Yeah.
There had been no central bank in the United States. There had been a federal banking system instituted in the 1860s, which, you know, was not, so it wasn't exactly a free banking era, but at any rate, there had been no formal central bank institution. And in 1907, there was a great panic on Wall Street that almost brought the Wall Street and the economy of the United States as a whole to a halt in kind of a 2008 type scenario. But, it was a hair's breadth away from bringing the whole system down, but it was saved by John Pierpont Morgan, who came in, swooped in and said, look, I'll underwrite this. I'll make sure it's all okay. Don't worry. And he's praised as some sort of hero for doing that. And then, of course, a few years later, all of his connected interests go to Jekyll Island to work on the problem of how to solve this problem with a central bank. And of course, so ultimately the offshoot of that, what ultimately comes from that is the Federal Reserve. Through a circuitous process. Basically, they put out their Jekyll Island plan, and it's rejected by the public because people know not to trust the interests behind it. But of course, they just have their plan B, which is pretty much the Federal Reserve anyway. But it's put up forth by the people who are supposedly against these banking interests. So yay, let's support it. And the Federal Reserve comes out of that. And what is the Federal Reserve? It is a cartel, formalization of a banking cartel over the banking system of the United States. And it is the fundamental power of issuance of the currency and control over the interest rate, which is the fundamental basis for the economy. Everything that happens in the economy can be fundamentally determined by the Federal Reserve, as we've seen over the last 7 or 8 years in the blowing up of the enormous bubble, equities bubble that we're in, bond bubble, housing bubble, subprime car bubble, all of this directly related to what the Federal Reserve is doing. So again, the banksters themselves created their own cartel, and heavily involved in that, as I say, was the oligarchical interests, including Walter Teagle, again, Standard Oil president, becoming one of the directors of the Federal Reserve in its early stages.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you mentioned some of the names. Morgan. Morgan dates back to his firm, goes back to London and the Rothschilds, if I'm correct.
Well, one way or another, there have been claims made that he was nothing other than a Rothschild agent, and at the end of his life, it was found that he only had 20% of his wealth or something. And the rest
yeah,
of the,
yeah.
I haven't seen any documentation of that, but certainly there were. His father did have connections in that London banking scene with Rothschild interests. So, I mean, there is certainly some sort of connection there.
It's my point is that these things are international. So we don't look at it as particularly an American system. They're all working within the very small club of elite. And of course, the Warburg family was a big international banking family because they were a German banking family as well.
Exactly right. And of course, the Rothschilds themselves are explicitly an international family with their five arrows shooting across Europe. Yeah,
that's right. That was their plan. So they took over finance. And at this point, I think we get to a point where, they're in a position, it's not just money, it's power, it's a vision, a worldview of things. And you get into the Green Revolution and the Gene Revolution, and their control of life itself. Want to get into that? Because this is through agriculture.
Yes, yes. So the Green Revolution, for people who don't know, Green Revolution in our day and age probably brings to mind the idea of, the green environmental movement. But the Green Revolution refers to that time in the 1960s and 70s, during which consolidation over the world food supply started to come together under the agribusiness model. And what this is, of course, is the introduction of various modern farming technologies around the world to various developing and third world nations. And this, of course, has always been portrayed as some sort of wonderful, amazing boon for humanity, and the incredible increase in yields and food supply over that time has been built on the back of this amazing revolution in industrial farming technologies that was spread by the benevolence of the Rockefeller Foundation and others who helped sponsor this into existence. It's a more complicated story than that in a number of different ways. One of them is that it was this Green Revolution, which was spread through the philanthropy of the U.S. government under such things as President Johnson's Food for Peace program, that also helped to consolidate new monopolies in the agricultural world. And this gave rise to what became a seed cartel that was known as the ABCD seed cartel, Archer Daniels, Midland, Bunge, Cargill, Louis-Dreyfus. That membership of that cartel has changed somewhat in recent years. But still, I mean, that was the basis for it at that time. And a lot of other big names that are still familiar to people today, DuPont and Dow Chemical and others. And others that are not so well known today, Hercules Powder and others. And of course, Monsanto getting into that mix. These companies really became these international giants during that era where these industrial farming technologies were being shipped around the world. And it was, I mean, it's an interesting multi-layer phenomenon where you have all of these industrial technologies, these fertilizers and tractors and irrigation and everything, making it extremely easy for a smaller number of people to farm larger amounts of land. So again, there's the sort of freeing up of labor, and you have to pay labor less, so you can save money that way, and you can produce more with all of these newfangled fertilizers and everything, or at least that's the way the story goes. And so it's, again, seen as this great boon for humanity. But not only, of course, do the oligarchs directly get to profit from such things as fertilizers, which are often derived from petrochemicals, and tractors, which run on petrochemicals and things of that nature, those kinds of direct benefits. But there are all sorts of secondary benefits for the oligarchs and, you know, losses for humanity, such as the incredible displacement that took place in a lot of these countries like India and Mexico and others, where these technologies are introduced in such a way that they, of course, benefit the landowners, who, generally speaking, are the rich, you know, landowning class themselves anyway, and to the detriment of the farm workers, who are generally living subsistence lives, you know, from subsistence wages from doing manual farm work, but then are displaced off of the farms. So they're completely, they're landless, they have nothing to their name. They ultimately, in a lot of these places, end up congregating in shanty towns in the edges of major urban centers and become the fodder for major industrial concerns in other countries that move in as part of the globalization efforts. And so they, you know, suck them up as slightly above slave labor, meaning these sweatshop conditions around the world to produce the petrochemically derived plastic crap for the first world. So, I mean, it's such a multi-layer operation on so many levels, and it so directly benefits so many of these industrial concerns that, again, it's hard to wrap your head around. But perhaps the key part of it, if there is a key part, is the consolidation over the food supply itself that you get from this. You have a handful of seed companies that are providing the basis for a growing percentage of the world's crops. And that, of course, starts to take on a whole new inflection when you add into the mix genetically modified crops, genetically modified seeds, the specter of Terminator seed technology, where although they're backing off from this and they're not selling it to the public this way anymore, and, oh, we won't do this, don't worry. But, of course, they have the technology to make not only patent life and patent these seeds that they can then claim is theirs, and if they find it on your field, they can come in and sue you. As Percy Schmeiser and many others have found out from Monsanto over the years. But also they can create these seeds that will only grow a crop once, and you can't save the seeds and plant them again the next year. That's a technology that exists because of this genetic manipulation. So this leads into the gene revolution, which is a continuation of the Green Revolution. We've had the Green Revolution. We saw this great increase of yields because of these modern industrial farming practices and all of that narrative. Well, now we've got the Gene Revolution, and it's going to be even better because we can genetically manipulate these crops down to the genome level, so we can specifically make crops that can resist all sorts of weather and don't need as much fertilizers and all of this. Or at least that's what it's being sold as. And no matter how many studies come out saying that, in fact, GM crops require more fertilizers, apparently that, you know, why let the facts get in the way of a good story? But the real scary part of this, again, is that there is a handful of companies, and generally speaking, oligarchically connected companies, including Bayer Crop Science, one of those IG Farben offshoots, now an offshoot of an offshoot, that is one of the key players in the genetically modified crop business, biotechnology, as they like to call it. That is supplying these seeds now that are, again, increasingly making it to the food supply. And it's gotten to the point, of course, now I think famously 90%+ of the soy in the United States is genetically modified and things of this nature. And again, this is being spread around the world through philanthropy. And, oh, every time there's, you know, U.S. food aid and aid of various sorts being offered to various countries, it is, of course, primarily genetically modified crops that are being offloaded on these countries, and often ones that couldn't be sold by these seed companies. So they're wrapped up in these philanthropic endeavors where they ultimately get paid from the U.S. government and the U.S. taxpayers for the privilege of sending these crops around the world and consolidating their control even more over these farmers. And another aspect of all of this is that these modern farming technologies, of course, come with a price tag, and often the farmers in these developing nations that are getting these tractors and fertilizer and everything in order to do this don't have the money to pay for it outright, so they have to get loans, which again are established through the banks of the, you know, Chase Manhattan and the other oligarchical connected banks. Every single place you turn here in this story, there is a bottom line for the oligarchical interests that are making money in all sorts of different ways from this and consolidating their control over the food supply itself, the very basis of what people are eating each and every day. And of course, I don't think most of your listeners will need to be told about the great worries and dangers of these genetically modified crops and the health concerns arising from them. Again, it's just so nightmarish that you could spend a lot more time than I did in this documentary talking about the various aspects of this.
Yeah, another book on that is Seeds of Destruction by William Engdahl.
Yes.
It's a good book.
Highly recommend.
And he also gets, you know, if you doubt that these people might have nefarious ideas or plotting or they might not have the people's best interest at heart, they've developed things like contraceptive corn.
So. Yes. They've even engineered the AIDS virus into corn.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah. And then you close out the show. You close out the documentary with the next step, and it's climate change. It's environmental hysteria. And, of course, we have Agenda 21, the Club of Rome, and all that. And that I think that's going to be your next – your follow-up on this one?
It certainly is. And okay. So all of this really is sort of preamble and setting the table for what I think is the main course, or at least what should concern us most in the 21st century, which is the next step in all of this. And as kind of mind-blowing and amazing and elaborate as these plans from the 20th century may have been, imagine how much more fundamental the control is going to be in the 21st century. And I think that this is the point at which we cannot understand this if all we are looking at is the money motive. I think obviously they have become very adept at finding ways to make money hand over fist at every single stage of this, as I've talked about in these various developments, the pharmaceutical industry and the modern agribusiness industry. But it's not fundamentally, I think, a monetary concern. Fundamentally, it's about power. And how do you consolidate power over the entire globe and life itself? And why would you do that? I think that's another big question. Most people could not wrap their minds around the desire to do that, why people would want that type of total control and why they would spend generations, literally generations, pursuing this goal. And so I think there's a couple of things I really want to try to flesh out in the follow-up to this, which is the ideology underlying this. What is it? What drives them? Why do they do this? And then how are they going to bring this about? And so that's going to hit on all of the key themes that I think have underlain the whole rise of the oligarchs and their interests and what's been driving them, which is eugenics, and then of course the switch over into population control and ultimately the various iterations of that, and then the creation of the modern environmental movement as a way of achieving that type of control.
Yeah, I think what we're dealing with is ultimately a spiritual battle, but it's being played out here in grim reality here on Earth. And perhaps it's it's that goes back to Milton, better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. So,
right,
yeah, maybe that's what we're dealing with here. So
that spirit. Well, yes, I generally don't go into the religious or spiritual side of these things. I'm sure there is. I mean, I don't see how you could have an intergenerational plan that you pursue like this without some conception of that. But however that is, I think there is an ideology behind it. And it's the same. Yeah. I mean, it's the same drive that we've seen throughout all of recorded human history. So it shouldn't be surprising. The drive to consolidate truly global control. And we've seen this from the very earliest tyrants and their quest to try to control all of known civilization at that time, all the way through to today. It's the same drive, but it's now fleshed out, and it has a scientific or a pseudoscientific basis that they truly believe they're genetically superior to the rest of humanity. And that's and it's inherently a might makes right philosophy, which is why they pursue it so ruthlessly and with so complete disregard for the human beings whose lives are being completely ruined by them.
Yeah, they have to impose this false scarcity, and this goes into the hysteria. And I think, that's why you get into things like transhumanism and some of this weird stuff where you can upload your spirit into a computer somewhere and become a god. Ray Kurzweil at Google, So that's what we're dealing with.
Perfecting the unperfected, squaring the circle, all of that.
But they learn nothing from the Tower of Babel. You can't do this. It's just, that's a whole other discussion. It seems to be the process just repeats itself over and over again. They never learn. Well, listen, James, I had you a very long time tonight, so I want to thank you. We covered a lot of ground, and you did an excellent job in distilling it and giving the listeners an idea of what the documentary is about.
We've spent more time than I did in the documentary itself, and yet still we've only scratched the surface.
Exactly. But it is. I mean, I highly recommend it. How Big Oil – what's that title again?
How Big Oil Conquered the World. The original title was The Rise of the Oiligarchy, but I realize most people wouldn't quite even understand what that means.
Yeah. So go to corporatereport.com. You can catch that video there, or you can see it on YouTube. Highly recommend it. Also, highly recommend some of the other videos. And, of course, I highly recommend his website and his material. And if you'd be so kind, if you listen to this stuff, you should support his work, because this stuff takes time, and time is not free. People have to eat, and you have a family to raise. So,
I do indeed.
So just think of that when you listen to his material. Anyway, listen, James, thanks a lot. We'll talk again in the future sometime.
Well, thank you for having me on and allowing me to expand on this. I think this is some pretty important information, so thanks for bringing it to your listeners.
Thank you and good night.